Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is James Forsher, filmmaker of Hiding in Hollywood on Anti-Semitism in Hollywood. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking recently about the way words and titles can become tainted, turn from being simple descriptions into insults. Sometimes this is accidental, just a word that seems ordinary but now becomes negatively charged because of events or chance. Sometimes it's the result of a concerted campaign to take a perfectly normal term and use it against somebody you don't like or respect, or simply want to defeat in an election or a PR campaign. Sometimes it's the result of an underlying level of bias or hostility emerging in the way words are used, or even a deliberate effort to hide a malign design in a cover word that signifies negative qualities without revealing the bias behind the usage. For example, the word steroid was originally, to most people, a category of drug prescribed for inflammation and illness, that's all. But during the baseball scandals of the early 2000s, it became clear that some players and athletes in lots of other sports were using steroids to gain an unfair advantage over their non-steroid-abusing peers. Steroid user, originally just a medical description, became a hostile phrase, a way to call someone a cheater, a bad apple. Steroid users can't get into the Baseball Hall of Fame, for example, and when they retire or pass away, the fact that they were identified as steroid users, male or female, track athletes were suspended or expelled, even went to prison for steroid use too, well, that's always included. Steroid became a kind of evil term. Not quite as bad as opioid has become in more recent years, but for similar reasons. People abusing something led to the word itself being understood to be a representation of evil. An example of a normal, positively understood word being turned into something negative deliberately, kind of a different thing, is the way that our politics have turned the word liberal into a kind of epithet. I remember when there were liberals, conservatives, and moderates, and nobody thought any of those terms were moral judgments. They just meant you had differing perspectives on politics, economics, perhaps social norms. Then, way back in the 1980s, boy, that's 40 years ago now, political operatives discovered that they could sneeringly say someone was a liberal. And if they did it with enough attitude, the idea that it meant something bad, especially if they repeated it enough, would stick to it. Somehow the terms conservative and moderate weren't treated the same way, and so suddenly being called a liberal, once a compliment or at least a non-judgmental way to recognize ideology, became a harsh criticism. That wasn't a logical change or something based in policy. It was just a way to take a normal word describing people on the other side of a political issue and make it sound as though they were evil or just completely imbecilic. Pretty soon, obviously liberal people were running away from the word liberal. I'm not a liberal. The third way I believe that a term changes meaning is when people use it as a code word to express a deep antipathy, even hate, without using the words they'd really like to use. The word Zionism has gone through this awful transformation over the years, but particularly so in the past year, since October 7th. As I've explained right here on Two Jewish, the word Zionism simply means we Jews have a right to return to our homeland in Israel, to have our own country as every other nation on earth has. It was the national aspiration of the Jewish people for nearly 2,000 years, following a millennium of sovereignty for Jews in Israel, and it manifested itself as the nation of Israel 76 years ago. While the idea of a modern, democratic, secular nation was controversial in the years leading to the creation of Israel, the term Zionism wasn't particularly so. It simply meant the Jewish dream and the movement to create a real country for our own people. After Israel was created, it had a remarkable, nearly miraculous victory over the Arab armies that sought to destroy the new Zionist entity. That's what Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and the other Arab states that promised to throw all the Jews into the Mediterranean Sea called the new nation of Israel. Note that term, Zionist entity. All those Arab countries swore they would never recognize a Jewish state, and they renewed that non-recognition after the 67 war. By using the term Zionist as a negative word, they sought to demonize Jews. The Arabs, not always the most original thinkers, were simply reviving a use of the word Zionist that was invented by the Tsarist secret police back in the bad old days of the Russian Empire, when they forged the evil anti-Semitic book, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That book created the conspiracy theory that there was some secret society of Jews controlling everything. An insane falsehood, a justification for the vicious anti-Semitism of the Tsarist regime and its directed pogroms and arrests. Of course, that same anti-Zionist insanity, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion conspiracy theory, has been adopted by a lot of anti-Semites ever since, from Henry Ford to Hitler to current ones like Kanye West, Nick Fuentes, or Ilhan Omar. And now, in the past year, the term Zionist, again, a word that just means we Jews have a right to our own country, like every other people on earth, and that Israel should not be destroyed and its Jews all murdered in a second Holocaust, that term Zionist has become a controversial term. It's now being turned into a kind of negative epithet. Even rational people who should know better are running from being called Zionists. That's just wrong. Being a Zionist is a proud label. It is a positive statement of Jewish identification and identity. It is not at all racist. Frankly, the majority of Israel's population has skins much darker than the people who are calling it racist. Zionism is not about genocide except to prevent others from committing genocide on the Jews. And when an evil, racist, totalitarian, theocratic Islamist regime like Iran's condemns Zionists, and foolish people accept that as some sort of face value ridicule, they are being duped and conned. When young people find it fashionable to condemn Israel for defending itself and claim anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, they are just wrong. Wear that word proudly. To be a Zionist is something powerful, positive, and meaningful in a world in which those labels are, well, hard to come by. And let's move the word back into the positive category. Using Zionism to recognize all the incredible good that Israel has accomplished in its remarkable 76 years. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's a classic early Zionist song, Halicha LeKesaria, The Journey to Caesarea. It's a poem written by Chana Senesh, a Hungarian Jewish poet and soldier who immigrated to Israel in the 1930s. She then returned to Hungary to try to rescue Jews from the Nazis and get them safely to Israel, which was then British-controlled Palestine. Chana Senesh parachuted in, was captured and tortured by the Gestapo for months, and then executed. She died at the age of 24. Chana Senesh was a heroine of the Zionist movement. She lives on in the fact of the state of Israel, where Jews will never again be herded into cattle cars or slaughtered wholesale by anti-Semites. You know, anti-Zionists. This version of Halicha LeKesaria of Eli Eli is sung by Sophie Millman. Eli. Eli. Shelo Igamer. לעולם החול והים That was Eli Eli, Halicha LeKesaria, sung by Israeli singer Sophie Milman. Our guest this morning, James Forsher, has been making his documentary on anti-Semitism in Hollywood for a very long time. Find out what's changed and how his perceptions of the current wave of anti-Semitism in Hollywood, well, how they shape his thoughts when we come back in just a moment right here on Too Jewish.
A great new class for everyone. This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but didn't get to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? In three fun, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. Rabbi Sam Kohan teaches what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. All classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but you must pre-register. Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try tasty Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. The classes are free, but you must pre-register. Call 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sundays or three consecutive Wednesdays this fall live with a Zoom option. There's no obligation and it's completely free. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish James Forsher. He's a Hollywood producer, a documentarian, long experience in the film industry, and is now kind of redoing his film on anti-Semitism in Hollywood, which goes back 100 years. So there's an irony to this, of course. So many people think the Jews invented Hollywood, which isn't too far from the truth. Tell us a little bit about the origins of that original anti-Semitism.
Well, it goes back to the very first days of the film industry. Thomas Edison actually was the guy in charge of motion pictures from the time he invented the first U.S. cameras. And what happened was the early Jewish pioneers, they started off as exhibitors of owning the Nickelodeons, and then they realized they should be producers too. So many of them tried to open up shop, and Thomas Edison hired detectives to go after them, a team of lawyers to stop them. And so it really is the very beginning of the kind of the anti-Semitic movement against Jews. Carl Lemley, who started Universal Studios, had almost 300 lawsuits filed against him. He countersued Edison, and Edison lost. And that was the end of Edison controlling motion pictures and the beginning of the Jewish pioneers being able to actually run their own studios.
So Lemley, who had many theaters, I guess they were originally Nickelodeons of some kind. He started in a different industry. He's kind of a hero, really, of the early development of motion pictures.
Yeah, he was the one that really took on Edison directly. The others didn't want to. They kind of avoided him, which didn't work that well. Lindley, who had a big studio with 10-foot walls, even though he was like a 5-foot tall guy, he was kind of Hercules for the Jews, and he really decided that we have to stop Edison and enough is enough. And he, you know, filed under the Monopoly Act at the time and was able to shut him down.
Edison liked to sue people, anybody who challenged his monopolistic hold on whatever he or his studio or the guys in his back office, I guess his lab, had invented. Once this was liberated, there were, you know, kind of Jewish studios developed that almost, not all of them, but most of them were pioneered by Jewish business people. How did that encourage anti-Semitism in a strange way?
Well, first of all, yeah, it, a lot of the heads of the studios were Jewish, but when you look at even back then, the workers, they were from all over. So it wasn't so much a Jewish industry. It was an industry that was open to Jews, which makes a big difference because at that time, very few businesses were open to Jews to work. So that attracted Jewish people to the industry. Unfortunately, you know, it was a competitive industry even back then. So the Jewish pioneers were hiring anyone who was really good and competent. And that's when the industry began, because it was brand new. There was nobody that could control them because there was no...
it was a new industry. There weren't any rules, really, right, initially?
No. So they were suddenly, within a few years, they were making hundreds of millions of dollars, which is, you know, billions of dollars in today's market. And that got the attention of some pretty powerful and pretty nasty people like William Randolph Hearst, who went after Zucker with a vengeance. And we cover that in our film, with that mogul war. Henry Ford, notorious anti-Semite, and
vicious,
in the
yeah.
International Jewelry, there's a his book about how bad the Jews were in the 20s. There's a whole chapter about Hollywood. I mean, he especially didn't like Hollywood because they had money, and he didn't like not being able to be in charge of it.
We will talk much more with James Forscher, especially not just about how the anti-Semitism came to permeate the way that Hollywood worked in a lot of ways, but also what's happened in the last year, which has been, well, shocking and dramatic. All that when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established almost 6 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is starting for school-age kids and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah program, Torah Tikes for the youngest, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org to sign up. Our services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night, 6:30 p.m. for Shabbat evening services and Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. Shabbat morning services, Torah reading, followed by Kiddush. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information. All of our services are in person and on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, Beitsimcha Tucson, and all of our classes are available on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, including Zionism, which are being taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. And High Holy Day services are available also. You can find them on our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2jewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There was a news story that you brought to our attention related to the Black Sea, and, well, tell us about it.
Right. So the Black Sea is an interesting region historically, culturally, linguistically, and otherwise, because we think of it as wedged between Turkey and the former Soviet Union. But the former Soviet Union, of course, has split into many different countries. And there's a few other important countries that border the Black Sea, like Bulgaria, Romania, and Georgia. So it's a very multi-ethnic, multilingual region. And at one point, the Black Sea was entirely Greek. It was the Pontic Greeks. And it was a Greek lake in the sense that the Mediterranean much later would be a Roman lake.
Yeah, it was all Greek settlements. So yeah. They colonized the whole area.
All over. And I once ran into descendants of those Pontic Greeks from the Black Sea coast in the capital of Armenia in Yerevan. They were eating lunch in a park and speaking Greek. So I said hello to them.
In Greek.
And of course.
Of course.
And, you know, tried to get their story, which eventually we switched into Russian. But it was quite interesting. But the point of this news story is that a pretty much intact ancient synagogue was found on the north shore of the Black Sea in an area which may be Ukraine today, may be Russia today. Hard to say. But it was found by Russian archaeologists and certified and, you know, stuff was collected and carefully preserved. And it is conclusive proof, according to the Russian archaeologists, that there were Jews in southern Russia, whether it's Russia today or not is an open question, but there were Jews in that part of the former Soviet Union, in that part of the former Tsarist Empire, for at least 2,000 years.
So this is Second Temple period synagogue.
Right, right. It's basically...
Of which there aren't that many out there. I mean, there are some, but that's not super common.
Right. There aren't a lot of ruins of synagogues outside of Israel from that early in history.
Right.
This was very early in the Christian era, if not even before the Christian. It's somewhere between 40 BCE and 40 CE.
Yeah, like contemporaneous would say the synagogue in Capernaum or something, and you know, in Israel. But really remarkable. So this is the Black Sea region.
Yeah.
This is Second Temple times.
And I suspect that, you know, the Jews had a lot of interactions with the Greek Empire. As it grew, they had more and more interactions. And there were Jews in Greece long before Jesus or any of his disciples were around. And probably a breakoff community from those Jews in Greece founded a synagogue in this obscure place on the steppes north of the Black Sea.
So, having been in the place that they believe is the oldest synagogue in history, out the Delos, which is a Greek island, actually, it's just off of Mykonos. It's not much of a synagogue, but it's identified by, you know, benches around the outside and a center podium. It seems like a Beit Knesset. That's the only other way to interpret it, I think. Only real way to interpret it. That's a fascinating maybe entree to talking about the Jews of the steppes, and maybe we can come back to that next week.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, Tom.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi walks into a bar. He has a long gray beard. He's wearing tzitzis, a black hat, coat, the whole package. And he has a frog on his shoulder. The bartender asks, "Where did you get that?" And the frog answers, "Brooklyn. They're everywhere." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Re'eh, fourth in the book of Deuteronomy, which follows a sequence of marvelous Torah portions in Devarim with yet another remarkable text. Re'eh includes one of the most radical statements in the whole Torah. Ki yiyeh v'cha evyon me'achad achecha be'achad she'arecha. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brothers, within one of your gates in the land the Lord your God will give you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your needy brother. Ki fatoach tiftach et yad chalo. You must open your hand to him and give him enough for whatever he lacks, whatever he wants. This commandment is not simply to provide the needs of the needy, not just to alleviate suffering, but to give them what they actually desire. Sustenance, security, a decent life. It is much more than we provide in our American society, in which the safety net has as many holes as net. It is a powerful, dramatic statement. Open your hand and surely give the needy poor what they ought to have. This is part of a strong economic agenda here in Deuteronomy. No one is supposed to accumulate great wealth or enormous power. No one is to be left destitute. Most importantly, our moral obligation is to see to it that none of our brothers and sisters are left without what they need in order to survive. Herein lies a foundational lesson on the morality of giving. Give not only what someone needs in your opinion. Give her or him enough to live reasonably and with dignity, and do so in a way that preserves the recipient's dignity. That is the true measure of tzedakah, of living justly and in righteousness. Judaism, at its heart, is pragmatic ethics. We are trained to make the world morally better through practical action. After exploring the Talmudic dictum that even those who receive charity must give something to those with less, the rabbis conclude tzedakah is meant to be a percentage of your whole income, not a hard figure, and the same percentage, whether it's 10% or 5% of gross income or some other number, should be given in good times and bad, even in crazy, strange, weird times. It's true that when there is less income, there will be a smaller absolute amount donated, but the percentage, and thus the integrity of the individual's morality, will be preserved. So open your hand and give a percentage of your gross income to help the poor. Do so freely and generously in good times, in tough times, at all times. It's the Jewish thing to do. It's the right thing. When we come back on Too Jewish in a moment, our guest, James Forsher, director, producer, and academic, will explore anti-Semitism in Hollywood. It's quite a story, both old and new. Hear all about it when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The bodies of six Israeli hostages were recovered from Gaza last week by the IDF, the Israeli army, and they showed signs of gunshots, indicating they were likely murdered by Hamas Palestinian terrorists, having been held in the Khan Yunis area in tunnels. The remains of Alex Dantzig, Yaakov Buchstav, Chaim Perry, Yoram Metzger, Nadav Popelwell, and Avraham Munder were brought back to Israel for burial. Forensic studies are still being conducted by the Israelis to finally determine their cause of death. The IDF has recovered the bodies of 18 hostages since the beginning of this long nightmare 10.5 months ago. When the United Nations marked International Day of Remembrance and Tribute to Victims of Terrorism last week, it treated some victims as more equal than others, said Gilad Erdan, the outgoing Israeli ambassador to the United Nations. The Israeli envoy posted a video walkthrough of an exhibit about global terror victims at UN headquarters in New York, in a place where all visitors enter the UN building. There are, in that space, mentions of the September 11th terror attacks in 2001, the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013, and references to terror in Indonesia and Kenya. "Gosh, what's missing?" Erdan asked. "There's not a single mention of any attack carried out by Palestinians against Israelis," he said. "We're about to mark a year, one full year, since the massacre, and the largest terrorist attack against Jews and Israelis since the Holocaust. Yet the UN doesn't think it needs to be displayed on its walls." "There is no place more corrupt and morally twisted than the UN. We must all unite to spread this message worldwide, demanding the closure and dismantling of this organization and the establishment of a new body that truly represents noble values," the Israeli ambassador to the UN said. While there was some optimism last week that a ceasefire in Gaza, including the release of all remaining hostages, could be effectuated, Hamas totally rejected the latest agreement brokered by Washington, Egypt, and Qatar. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that the Israeli government accepted a U.S. government proposal to release the remaining Israeli hostages in exchange for Hamas Palestinian terrorist prisoners held by Israel, as well as a ceasefire. But Hamas, now under the direction of mass murderer Yahya Sinwar, rejected the proposal. As Blinken said, "This is a decisive moment, probably the best, maybe the last opportunity to get the hostages home, to get a ceasefire, to put everyone on a better path to enduring peace and security. But so far, no deal." At the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, as at the Republican Convention earlier this summer, hostage families spoke incredibly movingly about their children, held by the brutal Palestinian terrorists in Gaza for over 300 days now. Rachel Goldberg-Polin and John Polin talked about their son, Hirsch Goldberg-Polin, a civilian who attended the Nova Music Festival and had his arm blown off and then was taken by Palestinian terrorist murderers into Gaza on October 7th. The family's powerful speeches received overwhelming support at the convention, as did the parents of American hostage Omer Nutra at the Republican National Convention earlier. Both conventions chanted, "Bring them home." After dozens of staffers at a Seattle museum walked off the job to protest an exhibit on anti-Semitism they claimed was Zionist, area Jewish groups and the museum all pledged the exhibit will now find a new home. Months later, the Jewish groups are still planning to mount a version of the exhibit called Confronting Hate Together, but they will have to do so without their original partners, the Black Heritage Society of Washington State and the museum dedicated to Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander heritage. Instead, the Jewish groups say the exhibit will now be housed in a Jewish space. The group cited circumstances out of our control and that the experience had left local Jews feeling isolated at a time of great need. Immense harm has been caused to the Jewish community by not being able to show this exhibit. The Washington State Jewish Historical Society and the Jewish Community Relations Council, JCRC of Greater Seattle, said. Anti-Semitism today is at its highest level in over 40 years. More allyship is needed to meet the moment. That's certainly true. The museum staffers particularly objected to a phrase in the exhibit, "Today, anti-Semitism is often disguised as anti-Zionism." You know, the truth is sometimes just a problem for people, isn't it? The virulent anti-Semitism in the far left, as in this Seattle museum controversy and the campus encampment and protest movement, has parallels on the right, of course. The execrable Candace Owens, a conservative talk show host with some 5.5 million followers, even more than Too Jewish has, continues to launch her war on the Jews and to advocate ancient and modern conspiracy theories. She has long advocated the medieval blood libel, claiming that Jews drink Christian blood. And last Sunday, Candace Owens claimed that the Zionist media empire is shielding criminals and protecting a criminal syndicate, as she describes it. Owen's rant included several inflammatory statements, such as, "We are existing right now in a Zionist media empire working to protect criminals." In particular, she went after celebrity Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, a past guest of Too Jewish, and Boteach's daughter, insanely claiming that Boteach killed Michael Jackson, the king of pop. Boteach was a friend of Michael Jackson's. That's a well-known fact. Owens, who is black and was fired from the Daily Wire conservative media company for her anti-Semitic rants and celebration of the October 7th Palestinian atrocities, encouraged her followers to take violent action against Rabbi Boteach and his daughter last week. Boteach fought back, filing an FBI complaint against Candace Owens. Man, this is a weird time for Jews in America and everywhere. While the vast majority of Americans are certainly not anti-Semitic, it's distressing to see both ends of the political spectrum aligning on these conspiracy theories. And yes, if you think the state of Israel shouldn't exist and Jews should be driven out of the land of Israel, you're just an anti-Semite. Anti-Zionism, again, is the categorical belief that alone among the nations of the world, only Jews shouldn't be allowed to have their own country, advocating the expulsion of 7.5 million Jews from their homeland. That's deeply racist and evil and genocidal. How can anyone fail to understand that that is anti-Semitic? And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. James Forsher has been producing films and directing them for TV and movies for a long time. He's an academic as well with a tremendous archive of films, and he's been working on his great film about anti-Semitism in Hollywood for, well, tell us how long exactly, Jim, if you would.
I haven't checked with the Guinness Book of World Record people, but this film may have the longest production period of any film. It goes back to 1962. And in 1962, my mom, who had just been fired by Colonel Parker and Elvis Presley because she was getting a divorce, teamed up with a friend of hers named Adolf Zucker II, and they created one of the earliest production companies with a woman in charge. And one of the shows they wanted to do was on Adolf Zucker's grandfather, Adolf Zucker, who created Paramount Studios. Bob Hope commissioned a script, and they went shopping, and they couldn't give it away. Which was kind of startling, considering this is one of the inventors of the film industry and TV industry. They gave up. 20 years later, when I started my career, I tried to pitch it, and I went around, and it opened up doors for me, but no one really wanted that particular film. And again, I wondered, like, what was wrong with a Jewish pioneer.
Maybe it was just too Jewish. I mean, let's be honest here.
Even though Zucker himself never uttered the word Jewish when he ran his industry, which is a whole story unto itself, what woke me up to maybe the reason was in 2022 when the Motion Picture Film Academy opened up its Film History Museum in L.A., and the headlines of a number of papers the next day was, "Where are the Jews?" And for some reason, they excluded any mention of the Jewish pioneers or any special exhibit.
Yeah, it was really just shocking and horrifying when you think about Zucker and, of course, you know, Louis B. Mayer and the Coen brothers, and almost most of the studios were created by Jews.
Right, and that exclusion, that is what really was one of the main drivers behind me saying, no, this is not a history, Zucker is not a history of Hollywood. Anti-Semitism is the history of Hollywood, and it's the giant elephant in the room. And then when I started looking at it that way, I went, oh my God, this is a huge story. And I got to tell you, I'm embarrassed that I over, you know, God knows how many films I did about Hollywood, I never touched that. But that is a major theme, and that became the focus of this documentary.
So this has been a very difficult year. I had Tova Feldshuh on last week, and the prominent actress, and she was saying, like, there's like four of us who are prominent supporters of Israel among all of the many Jewish actors. Everybody else is hiding. Not wrong, and it's brought forth kind of a wave of anti-Semitism, some of it in evidence at the Oscars. Tell us how that's affected you and this project.
Well, you know, I go back to before October 7th. I mean, not just the Film Academy, but the David Chappelle appearing on Saturday Night Live and saying that, oh, when he goes out to Hollywood, he sees a lot of Jews, like what Jews are walking around with a Star of David on them. But anyway, I listened to that, and that got a laugh. And then he talked about how the Jews may control Hollywood. And again, he got a laugh, and I just sat there and said, what is going on here? And so that was a kind of a wake-up call that, you know, people could even make jokes like that. And then, you know, over the last year and a half, we've had just growing anti-Semitism, open anti-Semitism, especially, you know, with the Nazi marches or neo-Nazi marches. And then after October 7th, it was the gloves came off, and then it was perfectly acceptable to knock Jews. And I have personal experience with it. I did a communication consultancy with a nonprofit locally, and without going into big details, it turned out that even though it was a nonprofit, these people were blatantly anti-Semitic, and one of them wrote me a letter which basically accused me of always wanting to get a better deal from everything. And I wrote the director. I said, I quit. I can't work with that. And I just had an epiphany that I've got to make this film and finish it and do it quickly because things are out of control.
Wow. That's just horrifying. I mean, that's just sort of standard anti-Semitic stuff, right? There's no subtlety to it. There's no ambiguity. This isn't, you're too supportive of Israel or something. I mean, my goodness.
No, they went right to the core. And yeah, it was one of those places where I always felt there was an underbelly of anti-Semitism there, but unfortunately, one of their new hires was not particularly the brightest bulb in the block, and he just listened to what they said, and then he wrote it to me as kind of a nasty attack that he, you know, this was something he was going to show the Jew, and it went back to bite them. I had raised over $100,000 for them, and I suddenly closed the door and walked away.
In addressing this issue in your film, you dig into not only the kind of obvious Henry Ford, that's an obvious anti-Semite, famous for the Dearborn Independent and publishing the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a terrible anti-Semitic screed, hating Jews for whatever reason. It's never been completely clear as to why. But there were official organs of the U.S. government that kind of acted in ways that influenced anti-Semitism. Can you talk about that a little bit?
A lot of those actually go back to William Randolph Hearst. I mean, Hearst and Zucker had very bad blood, and Hearst was determined to bring down Zucker. So Hearst had a lot of connections with the U.S. government during especially the early 20s, and he started antitrust actions against the whole motion picture industry. The industry was able to deal with it, but eventually it caught up, and the federal government broke up the theaters and the studios, and that all came from the original fights between Hearst and Zucker and Paramount.
Did the Hays Commission, I mean, I can't remember if that's the exact term, but...
Will Hays.
Will Hays. Were his actions also anti-Semitic or just, censorious?
Will Hays was actually very friendly with Zucker and the other moguls, and he was hired because he was a well-respected Protestant, well-connected political figure, and the Jewish studio owners realized they needed someone like Hays to represent the industry, so they called him the film czar. And so Hays went around the country saying, hey, I'm in charge of the Jews, don't worry, I'm just like you, and I got total control over it. And that worked until there was a kind of a breakdown of the Protestant church, and the Catholic church were able to really kind of muscle in and say, we're going to demonstrate, we're going to protest and boycott the industry unless we have more control over content. And Hays had no control over the Catholic group, so that's where Joe Breen came in, and Hays had to kind of like negotiate that, but that's Hays himself was definitely very helpful to the industry during the 20s.
In examining the kind of way that anti-Semitism has reemerged in this past year of the Gaza War, how has that impacted the film industry, in your opinion?
The film industry is going through a huge shakeup, largely because of streaming has changed the whole economic dynamic. That's the major driver of chaos. Then you've got all the different factions who have different sense of what how to deal with anti-Semitism within the industry and between each other. The title of my film is called Hiding in Hollywood.
Right.
And that's largely because that's what Jews over a century had to do. They let Will Hays take the battles, and Hayes's the people that took over as the film czars, Eric Johnson later and Jack Delaney. Nowadays, you don't have that protection, so it's everybody for themselves, number one. Number two, most of the large industries are not even controlled by Jews anymore and haven't been for a long time. So that's another confusion in terms of there's the industry is still being accused of being Jewish, but it's not. I mean, it's not now.
What caused that change? If it was run by Jews, many of the studios were led by Jewish business people who had created the studios, but then had to kind of submerge their Jewish identities or chose to. I mean, you mentioned that, was it Zucker, who had never used the word Jewish in the context of running Paramount. What changed in terms, was it that the studios got so big, they were bought by big corporations? Like, what was the transformation like? Why did it become, if you will, less Jewish?
I think it's probably just in the last 25 years that it went from Jewish control industries, second, even third generation, to the global entities that it's really hard to say who's in charge. I mean, Jeff Bezos, Amazon, now owns
Amazon
MGM,
Studios, right.
Elon Musk owns X or Twitter or whatever. And so all these new media industries are controlled by all manners of people from all walks of life. MGM, at one point, the lot now is Sony, and that's Japanese. I mean, so it just became an international company in an international business.
You've been working on this film for a long time. In what way has it changed, and what do you need to get it out there?
I started off as really a homage to Adolf Zucker.
In part based on that family connection, right?
Yeah. I mean, and I just had an emotional attachment to it. I knew Mr. Zucker. I actually was there when he was interviewed by my parents and my mom and Adolf II. So in doing it, everything kept pointing back to really what he was able to do was just fight the anti-Semitism, make it a success. And then when I took that story and added the Nazis in Hollywood, which was a real thing, and then World War II and how they were first accused of being a Jewish war and they had to deal with that, and then the House Un-American Activities Commission, and they were afraid because they were being called the Jewish commies. I mean, everything led back to a mirror of anti-Semitism in this culture. And I realized the story is not Zucker in the 20s. The story is 100 years of the industry dealing with this constant challenge of being accused of being Jewish. And as if that was a terrible thing, and all these horrible things were going to happen because of that. And suddenly, the Hollywood story is very different. I don't think it's ever been told quite this way.
Would Hollywood have even happened without these Jewish pioneers?
That's actually how I want to conclude the show. I really want to talk about how different Hollywood would be if Henry Ford had taken over and all the films were white and Christian. Thomas Edison didn't believe in feature films, so we may be watching 8 to 10 minute long films still because
powered by batteries instead of alternating current too. If Edison had his way,
right?
Where can people help out? Where can they find out more about you and about your movie?
This is kind of a magic moment. We've done the work. We're just at the point where we need a narrator and bring in a final editor to do a really good job of editing this piece together. So to get involved, all you have to do is go to a website called Seed and Spark, S-E-E-D and S-P-A-R-K, seedandspark.com. It's a crowdsourcing site. Just type in Hiding in Hollywood, and it'll take you to our site. It gives the full story of the film, and I'm really looking for, just people want to order a copy of it, $20, $25, with a signed poster, and that will help me finish this. I don't need that much. We've already raised a third just in the first week and a half. So we're getting close.
Yep.
We just need to kind of push through this last few weeks. And I really encourage people to do it because there's no guarantee that any network's going to take this show, largely because, it's a controversial topic. So it's going to be seen if people get the download and then share it. Share it at temples, share it at schools, share it with friends and social organizations. And I'm more than happy for this show to go all over the places. Just check this out. Here's my copy. Because it's important for the dialogue to start. And Hollywood is a great way and a safe way to have that dialogue.
I think it's great. And by the way, if you don't find a famous actor to do the narration, I'm available after the high holidays. Just let you know.
The way it's going nowadays, I may be calling you.
Please. Thank you so much, James. All the best and good luck getting this out there. And we will use it at my temple, I'm sure. Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it, Rabbi. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
A great new class for everyone. This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but didn't get to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? In 3 fun, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. Rabbi Sam Kohan teaches what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. All classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but you must pre-register. Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try tasty Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. The classes are free, but you must pre-register. Call 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on 3 consecutive Sundays or 3 consecutive Wednesdays this fall live with a Zoom option. There's no obligation and it's completely free. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be prominent journalist and author Jonathan Kaufman, talking about his excellent book, The Last Kings of Shanghai, discussing 2 remarkable Jewish families from Baghdad who built an empire in China. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha Friday night for services and Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, Kiddush, in person live and on our Facebook page. And sign up for This Is Judaism, a wonderful free class on everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. To play us out this morning, here's Israeli singer Osher Cohen, his song Tagidi Li, Tell Me, sung with Noah Kirel. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray profoundly, of justice and of peace.
תגידי לי, איך היופי שלך ככה משקר אותי, משחקת לי בראש וזה גומר אותי, הופכת את הכל למסובך איתי. אולי תזיזי לי את הגדר מחוץ ללב שלך, זה שורט אותי. את לא מבינה שזה דפוק ואת אוהבת אותי. אל תסתכלי עליי, אל תסתכלי עליי. את יודעת זה מחליש אותי, כי אם את לא אוהבת אותי
חשבתי זה אמיתי עכשיו הלכת ואין אותי אין אותי אין אותי את אש אבל אני אין אותי אז אם את לא אוהבת אותי תגידי מה עשיתי כי חשבתי זה אמיתי עכשיו הלכת ואין אותי אין אותי אין אותי את אש אבל אני אין אותי
אם אין אותך אז אין אותי תגיד אלו
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.